This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
And this year, I don't think we put our foot in our mouth about anything. Our feet in our mouths.
carry on. Go ahead.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 Coco. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. And I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Keats, Managing Editor at Voice San Diego. What's up, Andy?
What's up, pal?
Fellow Managing Editor Andrea Lopez Villafaña. ¿Qué pasa, Lopez?
Nada, Lewis. How are you?
Coming up on the show this week, more election results are in. The true horse race, the real horse race of real data, has played out. It's been a long wait for some races, as expected, and now we have more clarity on who won and how some of the key ballot initiatives fared. We'll go over what we know and what's still at stake. And with the election in the rearview mirror, homelessness remains the biggest story in the region. It's the second biggest story as well, and the third biggest story. We're going to talk about some new data about the city's towing practices, who gets towed and when, and what the city of San Diego is doing and some of the challenges facing people who do fall into homelessness. Finally, the childcare crisis has also worsened after 55 years and major local preschool has closed. We'll talk about their reasons and what it means for San Diego families and how we kind of predicted this about 6 months ago. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Every year, or every election year, we do this. We always just like talk about the results the night of the election. And we've gotten better, I think, in like couching things and, you know, expressing nuance about how things are going to change. And this year, I don't think we put our foot in our mouth about anything, but things have shifted since they started counting the 500,000 votes that were not counted on election night. And we have some news. Yeah. We got some different, the landscape of San Diego is a little bit different and it could still shift. It's still not done. They are still 15,000 votes short of the full count. Now, obviously the number of votes for all kinds of cities is going to be just tiny out of that. But some of these margins are tiny. So let's get into the big ones first. Measure B. This was the trash service fee proposal. The city of San Diego, obviously, as we've explained many thousands of times, does not charge a special fee for you if you put your trash out on a city maintained street in one of the city bins. But if you don't do that, you have to pay a private hauler to come.
Right.
And that affects most, but not all, apartment dwellers and the people who get the no fee trash collection are mostly, but not all, single family homes. That is called the People's Ordinance, and changing it has been sort of a windmill that the city leaders have tilted at for 100 years.
Yeah, is it in recent years? Has it been a windmill? It's more been, as I say, a third rail, right? Just something you just don't touch. You're just warned against touching.
You know, if you had a panel and it was about the city finances or about something the city wanted to do, and one of the guys would be like, well, we should, you know, build a roller coaster that takes everybody to City Hall.
Yeah.
And then be like, well, where are you going to get the money for that? And the first thing that people would say is, well, we could start paying for trash.
Yeah, but I feel like the tone of those comments was always in the realm of like, well, just because of the universe, we'll never be able to touch that thing. But if we could, there's some money sitting there. But it's not as though, I don't really get the feeling that anybody ever gave it much serious discussion as like something they were going to take on.
They weren't trying. And then a couple years ago, I guess it was last year, Council President Sean Elo Rivera proposed that we do just that, that we reform the law. Now, the change would not mean that a fee was implemented immediately. It would give the city the permission to go through the process of deciding what the fee should be, what it would pay for, and how it would be administered. So that's going to take a while. I can imagine actually some pretty big debates about it, how much it should be, when it should be implemented, all of those things, who it should affect.
Would be very funny if after all this they can't muster the political like capital to actually pass the fee.
It's not.
Do you think there'll be a task force?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Without question.
We've gathered community leaders.
There will be so much, so many opportunities for feedback. Let me tell you.
There's going to be a lot of feedback opportunities.
The number of stakeholders who will be convened. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be through the roof.
Yeah. And included.
Yeah.
Included. I mean,
voices.
Voices.
Yeah.
Taken into account.
One thing is for input. Sure. They're going to listen to the community.
Because Measure B looks like it's going to pass now. So on election night, it was not incredibly far behind. And we very appropriately couched that things could change significantly. But it had a few thousand votes to make up. It has now made those up, and it is up almost 3,000 votes on the yes side. And with only 15,000 votes left to count across the county, even if half of them go to the city of San Diego, you'd have to have a scenario where there's 8,000 votes in the city of San Diego. In order for this to win, the no side, in order for the no side to win, they'd have to get about 6,000 out of the remaining 8,000 votes, and that's not how it's been breaking. So,
Quite a departure.
So, I think it worked. I think it passed.
Yeah, I think so.
That's wild.
B is for bins.
We just watched history. B is for bins.
Go ahead. If you still got one of those flyers, frame it, put it up. The B is for bins flyer has been.
You know what's funny about that?
Remember indicated that, as a strategy.
They were always like, well, there's nothing. No, we can't say anything is going to be implemented because of this. Mm-hmm. But remember, they were like, but we can say you're going to get free bins. You're going to get. We can say that.
Yeah.
It's like, what else then?
So reporters can't discuss the tax as an inevitability. Fee. But they, fee. In fact, that's a fine correction. But they, the proponents, absolutely can presume that the free bins will come.
Huge win for the San Diego Municipal Employees Association, the major funder of that campaign, the largest union of city employees within the city of San Diego. They're ready to administer all of that. They're ready to go. And they're going to have to pay, as we talked about earlier, also for the service to the green bin, right? We're going to have to do a green bin for all
food
mulchable
waste.
Stuff.
Yeah, food waste.
And that's going to cost some money, so that's partly what this will pay for. So, fascinating development there. Again, it's about 2,900 votes ahead on the yes side, and looks like it's probably going to hold. Big change.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, we talked last week about the amount that Mayor Gloria was present in the campaigns for Measure B and C. It now looks like both will pass. For better or worse.
Yeah.
Does the strategy to not put him front and center, has that been blessed? Has that been vindicated?
Yeah. And you just mentioned it, Measure C. This was the exemption to the height limit for the entirety of the Midway area from the Old Town area up through Sports Arena. You'll be able to build as high as you need to accommodate the zoning and community plan for the area, the proposed housing and housing envisioned for the area, and of course, the big redevelopment of the sports arena and the new sports arena that they project to build in the area. Now, The reason we had to vote on it this year is because the opponents sued and won, and they say they're going to sue and win on basically the same terms that the city didn't. The UT, I think, wrote a whole piece about how they're going to sue and they'll have to vote on it a third time. That'd be fun. But I don't think that's...
The lawsuit essentially said, the first lawsuit said, the environmental report for the community plan area, which the city relied on to say that it didn't need an environmental report back in 2020 for the ballot measure.
For just the height limit, yeah.
They said that that environmental report did not consider the environmental effects on view corridors.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, as that may sound strange to somebody, but a typical California environmental impact report does, in fact, examine things like view corridors,
mm-hmm.
Scenic views.
Yeah.
That is part of the environment as far as that law is considered.
When you're on top of the Phil's Barbecue
right.
and you look towards the west, you should be able to see the taco shop.
Specifically in this case, it would be like things like if you're in Mission Hills, if you're outside the community
right.
and you look across it.
You right? should, yeah, you should be able to
have a clear view of Les Girls.
Girls, yes.
And so the city said, okay, the judge has ruled with you. We will augment the environmental report by doing a view analysis, which they did. The new lawsuit says, yes, but the all of this new structure has other effects that you still haven't considered, such as its effects on traffic and noise and pollution and other things that like will come with these taller buildings. And so you can't just continue to rely on that old environmental report, but with a new view analysis taped onto it. You need to do a whole new thing on all of these other effects. And so like, you know, the city is very confident that that will be wrong, but they were very confident in 2020 that the lawsuit was wrong.
Let's explain this for a second, because maybe you can help me understand this. So mm-hmm. what we're talking about is the community plan for this area, which includes the zoning for this area. That yeah. has been in place since before the previous ballot measure.
That's correct. Yeah, and the amount of housing you could build, the types of the place where there will be housing versus the place there will be industrial zoned land versus the place that there will be commercially zoned land, et cetera. All of that is spelled out in the community plan. It sets a level of new development that could be ultimately achieved, but it did not include a change to the height limit.
Okay.
So all the development is within that height.
The new development that could occur now without the height limit still must follow what is in the community plan that was... that predates the whole conversation. Mm-hmm.
So am I correct that the city's argument is that we are still bound by all of those rules in the community plan,
mm-hmm.
and thus the height limit change does affect view corridors?
Yeah.
We're going to go ahead and acknowledge that you might have a point on that and try to fix it for this new ballot measure. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it is still constrained by everything else, which we already did study, the impact of all of these new housing units and other plans within the community plan.
Correct.
And so there is no difference in those impacts because those are still constrained by the community plan.
Yeah, that's the city's argument. Now, the proponent's argument is that that's not true, that the taller buildings will necessarily have some impacts on noise and things like that.
Birds.
Yeah, sure. Right.
And lay girls.
Yes. So, I mean, they're basically arguing you can't just augment your old environmental report that didn't include tall buildings and say, well, now we'll take a look at views. You need a whole new environmental impact report.
Mm-hmm. If we have to vote on this again, and if I'm explaining this in 2 years or 4 years, maybe I should just quit.
Yeah, I'm out. I mean, to be clear, a sports arena redevelopment, if the city's selected developer
yeah.
goes forward with a project, that too will need an environmental report.
Right.
And if some other project elsewhere in Midway decides to go forward with a substantial redevelopment,
that's
that
different than the plan.
We probably shouldn't get into the extent to which that's true and untrue.
Okay.
There are different types of environmental reports, and even if you comply with the plan.
Just stop.
Yeah. All right.
This is too just, nerdy. Just
end.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but you have me on record. If we have to go and do this again, I'll probably have to leave.
My ideal scenario is that the city wins its appeal on the 2020 lawsuit.
So none of this matters.
But then loses the lawsuit on the 2022.
What?
Because that could happen. They are appealing the previous judge's decision.
Right.
And the proponents are suing this measure.
Right.
So I would love an appeals court to come in and say, "No, the judge had it wrong about the views." But then the lower court judge saying, "Yeah, you were also wrong about all the other stuff." That's just chaos.
Andrea, one of the things that made me laugh today is when you said, "I got a text from somebody I didn't know that said it's just 87 votes." And instead of writing back, "I don't know who you are. Can you just tell me who you are and we'll talk about what you're talking about?" You wrote, "I know, so close."
I just said, "So close." I actually just figured out who it was. But yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know in the moment.
We're talking about...
I would have done what you do. Just like move the conversation along, see if a little bit more information trickles out that's going to give you a hint. Yeah.
Okay, what we were talking about, though, the 87 votes is the difference between what race?
National City Mayor, Ron Morrison and Jose Rodriguez.
Morrison is clinging.
I don't know if you just noticed, but I can't pronounce that last name in English or Spanish. It's weird.
Rodriguez?
I can't. I just physically cannot pronounce it in English or Spanish.
Really?
Yeah.
It's
random, but
it seems like something I would struggle with. Or Andy, but not you.
Yeah.
National City Mayor's race, Ron Morrison.
And Jose. Rodriguez.
There you go.
So when we recorded on election night, it seemed clear that Ron Morrison had this because he was 8 percentage points up.
Yeah.
But as the votes have been counted since, and this is probably the one we were most off on as far as whether it was certain or not.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just 87 votes. Now, again, do the same breakdown. There's 15,000 votes left in the county, probably only a couple hundred, maybe a few hundred in National City. And how many of those would have to break for Jose Rodriguez to make it possible for him to catch up is unclear.
Especially knowing that there's another candidate in that race who takes some of those away.
Yeah, the incumbent.
Makes it harder to come back.
The incumbent mayor. But that's another thing we can conclude. The incumbent mayor did not get reelected.
Right.
But this is a different city if it's Jose Rodriguez versus if it's Ron Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Chula Vista, there was another race, not the mayor's race. I do not think Amar Campo-Najjar will catch up to John McCann. Similar dynamics. If a third of the 15,000 votes are in Chula Vista, Amar Campo-Najjar would have to win a really impressive number of them to catch up. And that seems unlikely, but who knows? But another impactful race in that city is the Chula Vista City Council. This is District 2. Jose Preciado was losing on election night, and now the count shows him ahead, but just by 100 votes out of about 15,000 cast. So still could flip again, but it looks like it's trending toward him. And if that's the case, Andy, that changes our analysis about Sandag. It ensures that the Democrats on the Chula Vista City Council, regardless of the mayor being a Republican, John McCann, can put somebody more in line with the Democratic consensus on transit on the Regional Transportation Board of Sandag, correct?
That's correct. Now, in Carlsbad 2 years ago, Democrats had a majority and they couldn't come to an agreement on who to support. And so Republican Mayor Matt Hall ended up going to Sandag anyway.
Yeah. Escondido, there was the case of the Democratic mayor wanting to go on Sandag, but the Republican city council members didn't want him to, and they just didn't have a person on Sandag.
Right. So, the appointment process is you can't necessarily guarantee that the majorities will act one way or another, but given the size of Chula Vista's vote at Sandag, I think it would be unlikely that three Democrats would appoint a Republican to that very powerful seat.
Yeah.
So chances are very good that Mayor John McCain McCann in Chula Vista will not be that city's representative at Sandep. I think it would be fair to say.
Got it. Okay. Let's correct a couple of things that we actually were right about on election night, and then we kind of hedged on, and then we were right about. So one of them is the Catherine Blakespear race. This was the state Senate District 38. This is the north part of San Diego County, coastal district, along with part of Orange County. We said, boy, she really crushed the opposition there. Republicans didn't have a good night in some of these areas, and that's evidence of that. Orange County showed up and made it much closer. Looks like it was going to trend against her, but then it trended back as more San Diego County votes came in, and it looks like she has secured that seat. That's a flip of Republican Pat Bates. She had represented the district for a long time, and now it's in Democratic hands. So they actually picked up a seat locally. And then across the area in the State Assembly, District 76, Brian Mainshine faced a very tough race against Christy Bruce Lane, a Republican. And he was up and then down, and now he's up.
Yes.
And he has secured it.
And the Associated Press has called the race for Mike Levin in the 49th Congressional District, overlaps a lot of the Blakespear District. And that was sort of similar as well. When we recorded, it seemed like he had a very healthy lead. Orange County votes came in very strong for his opponent.
And maybe we were wrong.
Super tight. It has now grown again. And, you know, history will show that in the end, he won by like, it'll be, you know, over 2 points, 3 points, something like that. Which won't go down as an especially close race at all, but we will have the memory imprinted in our brains of watching 2 weeks of results come in, and during which it was, for one stretch, very close.
Yeah. And as we mentioned, Escondido's seeing a change. 4 years ago, it elected a Democrat as mayor, Paul McNamara. He didn't exactly govern as a kind of consensus Democrat along the, like we just talked about, in the regional sense.
Yeah, he was often aligning with the North County rural disproportionately Republican Sandag board members against the urban large city Democratic mayors that are on that board.
But that wasn't enough to stop him from getting ousted. It looks like Dane White, Republican, has declared victory in that race. It's still a little close, but again, do the math, it'd be very hard for Paul McNamara to catch up. So it's tough to get these right. At first, we should all keep in mind the next election, we're going to make a couple adjustments. The first results are not indicative. They're the best poll out there. They're a great poll of results. But polls like this aren't quite accurate. So it's just hold it on some of the tough, tight races.
Yes. We will remember in 2 years.
I'm sure we will. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Friday morning, I got an email that has changed some things for me last week. Let me just back up a little bit. I live in Ocean Beach, and nearby, there was a family. Mason was the son. He was my son's age, and his mother was June, and I knew him pretty well. I talked to him pretty often. I gave them a basketball hoop. They were part of the neighborhood. My son and him weren't friends. They didn't hang out a lot, but every once in a while we would see them and talk to them. During the pandemic, I didn't see them much. I would see Mason skateboard by a lot. We'd say hi. And then I had this experience last week where I got an email. And it was June, his mom. And she said, I was just reading an article about homelessness, and I scrolled down and I saw it was you who wrote it. And I recognized you, and I'm just reaching out to you because several months ago I was evicted from our home, and I last night the police confiscated my vehicle and towed it away, and we are right now, this is the middle of the night, and I'm trying to stay warm under blankets with Mason next to me, and we're out on the street. And I read it, and I was just like, I was just deeply upset, obviously. Like, this was a very cold day. Remember, it was like when that cold front came in, it was very, very cold after the rainstorm had come by. And it was his birthday, she said, that day. And I was obviously deeply affected to think about my own son, the experience, and how... Also, how I didn't know that they were gone. I hadn't known that she was not part of the neighborhood anymore. She was, again, just a few doors down. And I did immediately make a few calls to people about what could we do to help them. The Housing Commission ended up acting very quickly, and PATH, the service provider, PATH, they went out and they were able to get June into a hotel. And the Housing for Homeless group has also been assisting, and they helped launch a GoFundMe. Now,
that's Amy Zamudio's group.
Yes, and Joanne Stanley. And it's all been just a very disorienting experience. So what happened also is a YouTuber who does van life YouTubes, like she has a following apparently across the country. She was hanging out in San Diego. I wouldn't say living, but she was hanging out in San Diego. She did a YouTube. She found the women after they'd been thrown out, and they were at Mission Bay with all their stuff around and the dogs and the kids. And she did a YouTube about it and mentioned me in it. And then it was just after that that the activists took a hold of it, and it became a local story. NBC has done a story about it, CBS. But I think this just brought the story full circle, where now homelessness is every part of my life. It's what we cover in this part, in this discussion about politics, policy, the future of the city. It's part of our my recreation with my daughter and our softball league. It's all that anyone talks about. It's our life at home and the people who are around us and trying to live and survive in their cars or walking by or in their tents. And now it's my neighbor or my former neighbor. And I don't know. I just am really upset about it all. Now they're it seems like going to get some help. And at the very same time, it's just incredible how these coincidences happen sometimes. The city released an audit from the independent auditor about towing, about when the city decides to confiscate vehicles with their private towing partners and under what circumstances. And sure enough, it found that the vast or sort of disproportionately affected group are the poorest people in San Diego, that they fall behind on their registration, they collect parking tickets, they park in places they're not supposed to, or all of the above. And in some cases, like with June and Mason, they were living in their car trying to figure out how to get out of that situation, and their home was taken. And I think we've said a lot lately that the dynamic needs to change as far as this being considered an emergency or some sort of bigger issue than just an issue in the city, like we might consider a pollution issue or a infrastructure issue or something like that, that this is an all-encompassing municipal emergency, just an urgent emergency. And I want to make one other point. There is this thing, when we see people living in their cars or living in their tents, to me, that represents their ambition for shelter, right? They want shelter. There's a lot of people like they want to be homeless. They are literally finding shelter and creating it because that's what we do as humans, right?
Creating a home, creating a community. Yeah.
Right. And I feel like all of our civic enforcement mechanisms are around them being thrown out of those situations, hitting true bottom before we can push them into our system, our warehousing system for them, right?
The shelter system from which they can be placed into medium-term housing situations and eventually long-term housing situations.
Basically. Yeah, and I think this was yet another vivid example to me of how rather than combat their current sheltering instinct and fight them and strip it from them because we can win because we have the power to, that it, that needs to be channeled. Like rather than kick June out on the street with Mason, which seems like, what good does that do? Like what entity is better off when you kick June out of her car after that? I can think of only one that benefits from that.
The towing company?
Yeah. What other entity benefits from that? We have a newly, now truly homeless person on the street. Four in this case.
Yeah, because there was another mother and child who were all living together.
Which means that the homeless population, like the actual street present homeless population, has now gone up by four. And a new tent, two tents probably, are going to appear. The city is, as from this audit, is not recovering its costs from this system when they have to sell the vehicles or whatever. And she now, and these women now have to try to get their cars out, which digs them deeper in the financial hole. Like, can you imagine being completely destitute and having to come up with impound fees, get your car out of that, and get a first month's rent and deposit for a rent? And I mean, the barrier to get them up into...
Just to get back where they were is a large lift now.
Just to get them back into the vehicle where they were living is a large lift, let alone the lift that they were already facing to get into that first month's rent.
Back to their home, yeah.
Right.
And I got to say, and the next person that says, well, they should just leave San Diego, to me, I'm going to erupt at. Because can you imagine moving at that point to what? Arizona? Salt Lake City? Boise? What? What are we talking about here? What are you going to do there? Whose house are you going to show up at there? Yeah. What money are you going to buy a hotel room there at?
What former neighbor are you going to be able to email to ask for some sort of, like, human connections are what makes a community. That is what it is. That's the definition. It's not the amorphous term that we use during city council meetings to say that we've listened to people. Community actually is the network of people who we all know and the relationships that bind them.
Right. And so I think we have to confront this moment differently. Mm-hmm. If people have a car like that, there has to be a place that you can say, okay, you can't be here. We've had too many complaints. I understand that. I'm dealing with that in the other part of my brain, mm-hmm. in the other part of my life. Mm-hmm. But they have to have a safe place to take them, to go, to take that vehicle. And taking their car doesn't help anybody except the towing company. And is that who we're working for? Because maybe that is. Maybe that's the whole deal. Maybe they get enough. Maybe that's part of the system that's we're creating here. Because they're the only ones winning. But if that's not the case, then get them into a place that it's safe for them to park and to find services and support and move on from there. Same thing with the tents. If somebody's wanting to put up a tent to shelter themselves, they want that shelter. Figure out a place where it's okay. Safe camping spots, safe parking lots. Those, if we treated this like a true emergency, we would have 15 of those opening every month, wherever possible, to try to get it to the point where these are safe and taken care of so that they're cleaner, they're easier for people to deal with, and we can have access to them more readily in these moments. But I don't know what's happening out there, and I feel like everything is designed to make it worse before they make it better. I want to recognize the people out there working as well, like Amy Zamudio and Joanne Stanley providing the services they are to help people work through that process of getting their cars back, of finding out how to recover their vouchers for housing, of getting into, you know, going through all the steps that we put on people to get out of this situation. Great. But also it seems like they're working well and more with the Housing Commission and the city's infrastructure. These aren't like competing entities anymore. They are working together and doing a lot. And I find that fascinating too. But I don't know. I mean, I was just really upset to think of them on the street that night. Mm-hmm. And why are we doing that? Why is that happening?
I mean, years now of covering this, every however long it is, a new individual story comes across that illustrates some element of this crisis, whether it's the Rashkes that Lisa wrote about that were, once again, it was like
everything was beating down on them.
Yes, it was every few months they encountered a new thing. And each one of those things you could like, and you know, there were commenters on our site or on Twitter who were second guessing the decisions that they made in each of those moments. And sure, maybe from the outside you can go litigate each of those moments. But it nonetheless, in as a whole, paints a picture of people who are trying their best, who are working and have many things going for them. They were a family. They had some assets. They had been employed recently. In this case, they had jobs at the time. They had one job at the time. And yet the system conspired for none of that to matter. And their situation kept getting worse and worse and worse, to the point that they reached out and said, like, people just need to know our story. Like, it's so amazing that, you know, we continue to be pushed further down this hill, that I want people to hear how it happened to us, to put a face on it. And like June and Mason seem to be another example of that. And the elements of the system that they illustrate are like, again, you can look at like five different areas where it's like the illogic of this towing policy is very clear when put at behind their faces and their personalities, or the like the haphazard nature of the resources and responses that we have, that a bunch of different groups and people that they knew, connections that they had, happened to be able to get them into a hotel room pretty quickly, mm-hmm. and that they have that now. But it's just as easy to imagine that not happening for them and them still being on the street. It feels like a small miracle that they ended up in a hotel room as quickly as they did, right? Like the number of people out there who could have had the exact same series of events and not end up in a hotel room within 3 days and take a look out on the streets. Obviously, that is the case for many of those people. It's anytime you look too closely at it, it just feels helpless and not getting better, and amazing that anyone has ever been lifted out of it. And the numbers are clear. Lots of people are being placed into shelters. Lots of people are being placed into permanent housing. And at the same time, so many more people are ending up on the street.
Yeah, I think there's also something going on where there's in order to feel, to ease your conscience about what's happening, there are people who argue that that the homeless right now are almost a subspecies of some kind. They're almost like just they're just different. They want it. They're drug addled. They're
mentally unwell. That some collection of their traits makes them want and need different things than the rest of us need, and therefore that we should think about them different.
And so what you just said strikes home, because one thing that June said in that video was, it feels like they want me to become one of them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It feels like they want, and you can see it, like she's not going to sleep well in 45 degree weather. Mm-hmm. She goes 4 or 5 days like that. what if somebody comes up and offers her, like Shawnee Lo Rivera said that one time, a pill to make it feel better? Mm-hmm. What if, like, what happens over 6 months of not sleeping well in the cold, in the drudgery and the dreary situation, that you can start to see a slide start to occur, right? Mm-hmm. And then, and so it's like, it's not to excuse anybody's situation or decisions, but this is not a one thing. There's June and Masons out there, and then there's people who are in much different situations.
In both the Rashkes and June and Mason situation, what is very clear is it's not, there's not one moment. There's not one moment that you can point to and say, if not for that, this wouldn't have happened. It's a series of moments, and it keeps happening, and they keep getting, you know, it's a system that applies pressure on them time and again and again.
But every piece of rhetoric that's coming from the leadership of the city, at least, is that this is only getting worse, mm-hmm. and it's not going to get better for a while. And we can't tell you what we're doing to make sure it doesn't get worse and in fact gets better soon. It's just other cities are bad too, and this is...
And we're doing a lot.
And we're doing a lot.
Please be clear that we're doing a lot, which, you know, if it seems like there are, there's a lot of money going around. There's a lot of action, right?
But I think when you take like all the rhetoric, the Bill Walton and everything, everybody is screaming for the same very basic thing, which is that this needs to be treated differently. The whole thing needs to be treated differently as a wholesale emergency, the same way we did the pandemic, the same way we would the tsunami that might come or would come or whatever. It needs to be treated as though something's different. Now, this is also not foreign to California. What are the grapes? What's the grapes of wrath about?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
People who, you know, move here out of desperation and find themselves in a complete, harrowing, destitute of survival and poverty, right? A situation of survival and poverty. And then what I've talked about, when in the 30s and I'm in the 40s, when people moved here in droves to take the jobs and had no housing. Like, cities have dealt with this over the decades, over the centuries, mm-hmm. and reinvented their housing situation, their sewage situation, everything. Like, what is our reinvention? What is our emergency that causes a reinvention here? Because if we don't do it, it's going to keep getting worse. And everything that everybody from Bill Walton to June are worried about is going to get worse. And nobody's given us the answer about like what, well, no, this and this are going to happen. Hang in there. Okay, I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this or not because I still want to learn more. I haven't had a chance to sit down with June and Mason and talk about what happened. Why were they evicted, by the way? There was an eviction moratorium. What happened? I don't know the answer to that yet, those kinds of things.
But that's like another, it's like, it's not one thing.
Right.
It's like there's the eviction, right? It's many moments on the way to the street.
Yeah, she lived in that home for 10 years. Like, what happened? And I need to know. Stay tuned. I will try to find out and learn more, and I'll do a broader piece of journalism about it. So what was it about? 7 months, 8 months ago, we did our cost of living week.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was that long
ago. I know.
Jeez.
It's a violent thing for you to say to me.
Sorry. And that was an exploration of all these costs and difficulties that families are dealing with in San Diego. And my contribution to it was about childcare. And I opened the story with a administrator at the Honey Bear Preschool, Rebecca Garcia. And I asked her, or actually our intern at the time, Alicia Wadwa, she asked them, what would it take to get a spot at the Honey Bear Preschool? So this is a place in the Point Loma area that has served the entire area for like 55 years. And it's one of those unique preschools that you can take your infant there and they can stay there through when they're turned four, right? There's mm-hmm. So dozens of kids are there at any given time, hundreds and hundreds of families, some of the most prominent ones. I think Mayor Kevin Faulkner had his kids there. Like, lots of prominent families have had their kids there. It's a very prominent place, but it's not, you know, like a elite place. This was, you know, a daycare slash preschool. Mm-hmm. And we asked her, like, what, you know, what would it take to get a kid there now, like with the wait list and accessibility you have? And she's like, well, look, we can't find teachers. It's very difficult to pay enough to attract people to come here. And
this is after pandemic.
This is after the pandemic. And the pandemic just crushed these places. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, is there a spot? And she said, I have no idea. It's going to take a long time if you ask now to get a spot. So later, she talked about, you know, finding qualified teachers has been very difficult. The prices of everything have increased. Everything that their supplies, it's all just become, she called it, a vicious cycle. Well, just this week, we learned that Honey Bear was closing. So it was, the owners said that they can't deal with the costs anymore, that it was a very difficult decision for them to make. But they're also dealing with something else that we mentioned in that story, which is that the state expanded the universal TK program. This was for four-year-olds can go to school as far as transitional kindergarten. Your son did it, right?
My son is in transitional kindergarten right now, yes.
And which is a great benefit for those families. They don't have to pay for that those days anymore. But that means that one of the very basic fundamentals of the economies of these daycares and preschools was ripped out. Like the very basic subsidy in essence that 4-year-olds provide, they don't need as many teachers to oversee them, and thus their tuition can be used to subsidize the younger kids, and that's just a cycle that they had.
Yeah, and like if you've never had kids and you don't know, it's common, but your youngest kids cost the most.
Yeah.
Their price declines as they get older because the demands on them get lesser. But even at that lower cost, they are still the most profitable kids for these daycares because...
That sounds so funny.
I think it's more accurate than a subsidy, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they
I hear you. I'm with you. I didn't laugh. That was these dorks.
Yeah, the profitability of a 4-year-old is much higher for a daycare than a 6-month-old. 6-month-old requires lots of care. Pulling the 4-year-old out of that system, leaving you only with your, you know, 6 months old to 3 years old, breaks the economic model of that these private companies have come to rely on. So like the state in this case is like an apex predator, walking into the ecosystem of childcare without regard for what it's doing to that ecosystem.
And again, 6-8 months ago, we wrote about how that was a likely consequence of this. Now, this was a benefit, and the governor and everybody characterized it as a benefit, and a lot of people are benefiting.
To be perfectly clear, my son started at UTK 3 months ago, and his learning level has skyrocketed from being in a daycare program. I'm thrilled as a parent. But I'm also a parent of a 2-year-old who's still left back in that daycare system. It's not an either or proposition, right?
Right.
Like it's a genuine ecosystem that as a working parent and as a child, you really can't opt out of unless you're a stay at home parent. That's like really the only way out of this system. And so, even then it's not really, because by 3 or 4, you're going to want to be in something.
So we're talking about families that can afford and access childcare.
Yeah.
Before the pandemic, only 40% of families with 2 working parents or a single parent had access, or at least there was enough spots for them. Right. Only 40% could be served by the childcare system as it was before the pandemic.
Yeah.
After the pandemic, we lost 10% of those spots. And so now we're one of the keywords. I mean, you lose a Honey Bear, that's like a percent. Like things keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw it. Everybody saw it coming. This was Aaron Hojboom from the San Diego for Every Child movement. This is a collaboration of a bunch of agencies that are worried about the childcare crisis. She says, this is again 8 months ago. She said, I think until we see substantial state and federal local investment, it's going to get worse. Not kind of worse, exponentially worse. Just to be clear, this is another emergency. in the city. If you are a working family, you have to have two parents working or a single working parent, you got nothing unless you've got a support system of neighbors and families or some sort of alternate like schedule with your spouse or something, because the system is crumbling around you. And there's no answer. There's no plan for it.
It's just getting worse.
Yeah, and like, you know, the state had a lot of money to spare during the pandemic. And one of the things it decided to create was the universal TK system. It did so without lots of guidance to school districts. School districts have been left to their own devices to figure out what that meant. And speaking only for the San Diego Unified School District, where my kid goes, they've done a fantastic job of it. They figured it out. They figured it out on the fly. It's been clear that they're figuring it out on the fly, but it's been fantastic experience for us so far. But nonetheless, like, there are ripple effects of doing something that grand. And so far, the state's response has been to figure it out as they go.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you know, if you take your kid out of daycare and you put them into public school ends at like 2 o'clock for most schools. And on Wednesday, it ends at noon. Well, your private daycare programs usually go till 5 or 6. So now you need after school care. After school care's licensing requirements at the time that Universal TK started did not allow like half of the kids that were newly able to go to aftercare or to UTK to go to aftercare. Their license didn't allow it. They mm-hmm. were too young to go to the after school programs. So there was this whole cohort of kids who were suddenly able to go to public education, free public education, whose parents did not even have the option of sending them to an after-school program because they were too young for it per the state's licensing requirements. Now, the state changed those licensing requirements, but like they didn't do it until well into the school year, and they got confronted with this problem. They didn't foresee it. They didn't change it to make sure that it was in place before UTK started. They saw a crisis, and then they had to fix it on the fly. And I'm sure that will have unintended consequences as well. Like, they're making a big thing, and then they're waiting to find out what problems they create and then fixing them as they come.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. The people who often bear the brunt of this are women and their careers and what needs to, you know, if you don't, again, have an immediate network to lean on for this situation, it's going to affect and has traditionally affected women. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening to the Voice San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. I'm just straight. Keep up with all our stories and takes on the news with the Morning Report, our most popular newsletter. Get it at vosd.org/newsletters. That's vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrew Keats is Managing Editor. Andrea Lopez Villafana is also Managing Editor. And Nate John takes all of the things we say and makes them coherent every week. And we are very grateful for that. He is our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.